feeling.
This is the Mike McFeely Show.
The Mike McFeely Show.
On 970 WDAY.
He did it to me again. Johnson did it to me again. He left the earphones up at like 9.5 on a scale of 10.
Ah.
It goes to
11.
Jeez. Spinal tap.
Yeah. I got it. I'm not totally a nerd.
I just wanted...
I understand the joke.
Okay.
You didn't have to explain it to me. Thank you. I'm actually somewhat hip on some of these things. It's believe it, looking at me, it's hard to believe, but I'm actually
a little hip.
A little hip on some pop culture stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm not just all sports and politics. I mean, got some other stuff going on. But wow, I can't hear anything now, so I'm gonna be talking loud for the rest of the show. Welcome to the Mike McFeely Show. It is a Wednesday in Fargo, Moorhead on 970 WDAY. And goodness gracious, the images out of Houston and Southeast Texas continue to be remarkable, in an amazing and in a bad, sad way. But I wanted to get in a couple of our meteorologists from WDAY TV just to kind of, I don't want to say put a bow on it because it's not done yet, but I think, and we'll ask Lauren Hilko here in just a moment, I think it's moving on now from Houston and that area. And I actually thought I saw something this morning, Lauren, about they might be getting some sunshine in Houston today, which would be amazing for them, I suppose, right?
Yeah, that was the popular tweet and stuff. I mean, they're finally getting some sunshine and relief from all the rain. It actually made a third landfall during the overnight period just west of Cameron, Louisiana. So this system just continued to sit, made its first landfall, wrapped around, made a second, and now it made a third right near that Texas and Louisiana line. And overnight, about 20 inches fell between Beaumont to Port Arthur.
20 inches overnight?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Jeepers. So the hurricane, when did it first make landfall?
Because
this has been going on for a while. It's been like 5 days or something, hasn't it, since it went ashore?
Yeah, it initially made landfall Friday night into early Saturday morning.
Yeah.
And it moved inland and then looped back around and made a second landfall. And it's just been sitting over the same area because, like we talked about a couple days ago.
Friday it was, I think you and I talked,
about the blocking pattern.
Yeah.
And that's still in effect where you have those two high pressure systems, this sitting in the middle. And it didn't get much of a budge, moving very slowly, just dumping heavy rain over the same areas. And, I mean, U.S. record rainfall totals from this event.
So when it goes out, back out into the Gulf,
mm-hmm.
does that cause it then to pick up more moisture and more energy? So it just
Correct. Keeps
on looping around and just dumping more rainfall?
Yep. The Gulf is in water is what it wants. So once it makes landfall, that's usually when it starts to dissipate. But it continued to have a name even throughout. So, I mean, it just continued to stay at that tropical storm status, even when it made landfall the second time. Eventually, though, as it gets more inland or with the new projected track, it's eventually going to weaken to a depression. But still a tropical storm when it made landfall for the third time, and it stayed that way and stayed that status through much of its life cycle.
Andrew Whitmire, you are more tuned in on some of the numbers here. And Lauren just mentioned 20 inches overnight again. Give us some of the totals that we've been seeing in some of the areas, because it is, I think, as Lauren said, a record rainfall.
Yeah, so we're going to start with that record at Cedar Bayou. Again, Cedar Bayou, 551.88 inches. That's 4.32 feet of water. And that...
Think about that. That's almost 4.5 feet of water, vertical 4.5 feet. I'm about 6 feet tall.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. about the same
so
here,
it's,
yeah.
I mean, it would come up to my neck.
Yeah.
Just in rainfall.
That's just rainfall.
In a
That's
short
not
period
streams
of time.
Overdoing the right. banks or whatnot, levees failing. That's just rainfall
Good
over
Lord.
A 3 day period.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. All right. Keep going.
So that breaks the U.S. record, continental record for a tropical storm system. And it's only 0.12 inches from breaking the all time record for the entire 50 states of the United States of America for rainfall.
That's incredible. That could not happen around here, right? I mean, just because we don't have the Gulf of Mexico where it could keep cycling through and picking up more moisture, we could get what?
Our highest 3 day total here in Fargo Moorhead, 7.02 inches.
Okay.
And that was set back on June 21st of 2000.
And that seemed, if we get 6 inches of rain or that was incredible. amount of rainfall in a short period of time around here. And that's not even close.
No,
that's 45 inches short of where this town in Texas got.
Yeah. And they received that, you know, our record of 7 inches here in a 3 day total. They received that in a matter of hours.
Jeepers creepers. Wow. Yeah. Okay. So, is that town done then with their rainfall for now? Or is that
for now they're done, but now the concern is levees failing because the levees weren't built to handle this much pressure from the rising waters in creeks and streams. So now that's the other concern is, are these levees going to fail and cause more flooding?
How big is the area? Because we've all seen some of the aerial photos of Houston and downtown and some of the suburbs. But if we could go up in a satellite or in a plane, how big of an area of land is covered by water in South Texas?
Pretty much
right now,
the entire southeast portion of Texas, just about a little bit east of Dallas is affected from the storm all the way into portions of Louisiana. So we're talking, you know, millions of acres here.
I have not been to that area. I think I stopped into the Houston airport once to make a connection. What's the topography like? Is it mostly flat? Do we know? It's coastal area, so I'm guessing it's probably pretty flat, so there's not place for the water to run necessarily.
Yeah, it's very similar to North Dakota. You might get into, you know, some features that we see over in northwestern Minnesota. But for the most part, you know, just a few hills here and there, no big mountain features whatsoever. So the water is pretty much just standing.
It's just going to sit there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's is there 4 feet of water or more in some of the, just standing in some of these places? I guess when I see the photos and the videos, it's...
There's some locations that they have over 7 feet of water just from those, like I said, the streams coming in and mixing in with that rainfall totals. And I've seen just local reports from, they're not official observation points, but just the local people are reporting over 72 inches of rainfall even. And that 51.88 inches, that was just an official observation. So when you factor in the ones that are not official yet and they're just public reports, they're coming in over 6 feet of just rainfall.
And you may know this and you may not, but I'm on, you know, the Twitter and stuff all day. But there was, it's some ungodly amount of water they're predicting. It's like trillions of gallons of water that's been dumped in this area. Have you seen some of those numbers? It's remarkable.
Yeah, it's over two to four times our yearly precipitation here in North Dakota is what they received in a 3 day total.
Yeah, I mean, think about that.
Yeah, we usually see about 15.88 inches of precipitation. That includes water and snow equivalent per year.
This is very uncommon for the United States. Are there other areas that get rain like this in tropical areas or anything? I mean, or is this like, you know, I mean, is it unusual for the entire planet to get this type of rain in one shot?
I'm not certain about the entire planet, but here in the United States, I mean, this is very uncommon because usually when you get a tropical storm, it has its driving factors from the upper-level jet, so it continues to move, like you would think. But because of this blocking pattern, it just kept it stationary. So this is something that doesn't happen that often, a very unusual case.
Southwest India is probably the only location here besides the United this storm system that receives rainfall from the monsoons that constantly just battle the southwestern portion of India. But again, that's system after system, not one system itself, which is why this tropical storm Harvey is so detrimental.
So I heard the mayor of New Orleans, I think it was last night, came out and said that he believes that Hurricane Harvey or tropical storm Harvey is not going to hit New Orleans. Is that, as far as we know, accurate, that they're not going to get pounded?
It looks like it's to the west, and then also it looks like it's going to track through central portions, so kind of like dividing a line through
the
middle.
And what I was seeing too on social media, which was kind of fascinating, if you think of where the storm first tracked when it was still a hurricane, if it had fallen just, you know, 300 miles to the east, imagine what would have happened, the same location that Katrina hit.
Yep. And
yesterday, I'm pretty sure, was the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. So it's happening all around the same time of a lot of major ones that were occurring in record-breaking and memorable.
We're still not done with the tropics yet. There's still other systems developing that we're going to have to keep a close eye on down in Texas, the Gulf of Mexico, Florida, Louisiana.
And that was my next question was, is this area, now that's been flooded, it's not likely they're going to get these amounts of rain, but
we're not
entering a dry season, right? I mean,
we're not even at the peak of hurricane season. The peak of hurricane season is usually the first week of September. That's usually when it peaks. And it can go through November, the beginning of November, so much of the month of October. So, I mean, there is something that is formed off of the west coast of Africa that they're keeping an eye on. When I was looking, it has 100% chance they're thinking of forming into something. It's still far out, so they wouldn't know where it's going to track, but that's something that's worth keeping an eye on because, I mean, it could affect somewhere in the United States. It's hard to say this far out.
I'm going to read something here, and I can't vouch for its accuracy, but I don't doubt it because I know the person that did this. His name is Dale Wetzel. He's a former reporter, now works for the State Department of Education. Dale says, weather experts have estimated Harvey has dumped 19 to 20 trillion gallons of water on Texas. Let's assume the 20 trillion figure is right. It takes 27,154 gallons of water to cover an acre of land with 1 inch of water. North Dakota's surface area is 70,762 square miles, which is 45 million roughly acres. To cover North Dakota with an inch of water would require 1.23 trillion gallons of water. 20 trillion gallons would cover the entire state of North Dakota with about 16.3 inches of water.
Yeah, it would be.
Think about that.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
My God. Lauren and Andrew, thank you. Thanks for stopping by. It's kind of gotten buried in our area because of the stuff with the Gray Wind murder. Yeah. But this is just an amazing once-in-a-lifetime story and a tragedy, really. I mean,
really
going on in Texas. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it. Lauren Hilko, Andrew Whitmire. We got to take a break on the Mike McFeely Show. It is 8:50. My boat, Radio Waves, is sponsored by Bottle Barn Liquors, Jordal Custom Homes, Windows Plus, Heart of Lakes Meats in Pelican Rapids, Dave Noah of Remax Legacy, and FM Water Systems. Back in a second, set up the rest of the show on 970 and 93.1. It is 8:54 on the Mike McFeely Show, 970 WDAY. I've been trying really hard during this disaster to stay away from the political side of things. I don't think it's appropriate to go down the political side of things quite yet, because what's happening in Texas right now is an unprecedented, not only a natural disaster, but a humanitarian disaster and a disaster at every level. And so y'all know me to not be the biggest Donald Trump fan in the world, but I just don't think it's appropriate right now for people in politics or in the media to be bashing Donald Trump right now. And the same way, and I'll point this out, the same way I don't think it's appropriate for Donald Trump to be wearing USA hats that he sells on his website as a marketing ploy. But I'm going to stay away from that. I'm not going to hammer on Trump for doing that because that's on the scale of human disaster that's going on in Texas right now. That's where the focus has to be. And at some point, you know, we can look back at this and we can judge politically who did a good job or who did a bad job or whatever. But as much as I just don't like Trump, I'm not going to sit and hammer on him for what he's doing or what he's not doing. There'll be a time and a place for that, I think. And actually, I think if you're a Democrat right now, you know, part of the Democratic, the actual party and the machine that runs the political, you know, Democrats in the country, I think you're actually hurting yourself right now if you're going after Trump, because people don't want to hear it right now. They're worried more about the people, I hope, and more about what's happening in Texas than they are about the political side of things. Alex. Hi, Alex. You're on the Mike McFeely Show. Go ahead.
So on a scale of humanitarian disaster, Katrina was 10 times worse than in Texas. And I don't think that has a lot to do with politics. I don't know if it's why it seems like they're handling it so much better in Houston than they did in New Orleans. But you can say as far as economic disaster, this, I don't know which one's worse, but as far as the humanitarian aspect of it, it was way worse.
Well, I think in Katrina, I think the number I heard was 1,800 or 1,800 people died as a result of Katrina. And thankfully, this Harvey disaster, the deaths, people have died, but it's nowhere near 1,800 people.
Well, you had levees fail in New Orleans, and you didn't have levees failing to the scope that you did.
Yep. No,
in Houston,
right.
Like that. But right. Yeah, and I don't know, like you say, politics aside, but this doesn't even compare to the humanitarian disaster of Katrina.
All right. Okay. Alex, thank you. And I don't necessarily need to or, you know, want to compare the two. I think that what's going on right now is horrible. I don't know that it's a contest, but certainly the federal response to Katrina was awful, right? I mean, that was the whole "you're doing a great job, Brownie" line from George W. Bush, and the response of the federal government was in itself disastrous, and what happened was disastrous. It appears so far that with Harvey, that has not been the case. But again, I haven't delved into it that deeply because I've been so engrossed with the local news happening with the Gray Wind stuff, that I just haven't been reading every single word about Harvey like we did about Katrina. What was it, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, whatever the heck it was. And so we'll see what happens. Email comes in and says, Trump has no heart except for himself. I don't disagree, but I'm just not going to go down that road right now. I'm watching, I'm seeing what he's doing. I'm seeing some of the odd things that he's doing, but I'm not going to go down that road. I'm just not going to. And you can, if you're a liberal out there and you're going to, you know, you think that I should be pounding on Trump because of the way he's responded to this, it's just not going to happen. I don't want to make it political, because it's just not the time or the place for it. It just doesn't help at this point. As I said, I think last Friday, I want him to do well with this, because that means that the people will be handled well and taken care of. I don't want Trump to fail in his handling of the Hurricane Harvey response. I want him to do well, because that means that the people will turn out okay. We got to run. Thomas Ambrosio. What's going on in the world? Probably bad stuff. We'll talk about that next.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane. And Lenny Bruce is not a plane.
The end of the world as we know it. Well, we hope not. We hope that's just a song that we play as an intro to our chats on Wednesdays with Thomas Ambrosio, political science professor at North Dakota State University. The international stuff, Doctor, has been sort of buried under an avalanche of local news.
Local news, of course.
And then, of course, the Houston stuff is just astounding, what's going on down there. And so I really have not followed much about what's going on in the world. Are we any closer to the nuclear holocaust today than we were last week?
Guam is back on the menu.
really?
Yes.
Something happened with Japan. Were the people in Japan taking cover because of a missile launch or something? What was going on there?
North Korea, in a desire to continue to desire to provocate, shot some missiles over Japan. over Japanese airspace. And, of course, the Japanese government reacted very negatively to this, and we reacted very, very negatively to this, but not as kind of fire and fury language that we've seen with the intercontinental ballistic missile test. This was an intermediate range test, which, you know, the missile could not hit the United States. And that's kind of what we're most concerned about. But this is kind of a step up. And North Korea has done things like this before, but this is kind of North Korea saying, you know, not only obviously could we hit Japan earlier, but we're going to shoot something over Japanese territory. The Japanese have reacted, again, negatively to this. The prime minister has come out very strongly and said they have the North Korea, or that Japan's got to start taking more, not aggressive steps, but more active steps in countering North Korea. Now, what does that mean? I don't know. But what's interesting about this, and you know, the fact that Guam is back on the menu, is that the North Korean government came out and said this is a prelude to a possible attack on Guam or containment of Guam. And, of course, Guam is a U.S. Island in the South Pacific that we got during World War II. And it is strategically important because it is where our one of our big bomber bases in the Pacific is. So a lot of the bombers that will fly over North Korea trying to intimidate them come from Guam itself. So they're not on the Korean Peninsula.
The president an hour ago tweeted the following words
regarding
North Korea.
Ooh.
Donald J. Trump at Real Donald Trump, his Twitter handle, says the U.S. has been talking to North Korea and paying them extortion money for 25 years. Talking is not the answer. Exclamation point.
Yes.
So what does that mean? What is the president saying in his tweet? That it's time for action against North Korea and not just words?
Well, this is, you know, Trump has said things like this. Actually, this is kind of a toned down statement in some ways from Donald Trump when it comes to North Korea. But Donald Trump has been kind of beating this drum, which is that all options are on the table, which was also something that we came out and said, which we always say. That includes, of course, military force, but that there's no point in talking. And that we've been talking to North Korea, or trying to talk to them for decades. I mean, this goes all the way back to the Clinton administration. But as I've said before, the options that we have today are no better than Clinton had in the 1990s. The same dynamics are there. If someone pulls a trigger, you're going to have one of the most populous cities on the planet go up in flames, which is Seoul, South Korea. So Trump, I think this is part of we're both kind of playing a pressure game, and North Korea and the United States. And in the United States in particular is trying to, the way I see it is that we're trying to pressure North Korea to back down, which they're really not going to back down. But it's also directed at China to put pressure on North Korea. And that assumes that China can change North Korean actions and policy, and it's unclear that can happen.
We go over this every week.
It's
always the same discussion. And I had somebody bring it up, I think yesterday in the program, saying, you know, what are we going to do? There's no good option here.
No,
because you
no.
can't, you know, you can't assassinate Kim Jong-un. Well, I guess you could, but I'm not sure.
That has actually been talked about more in South Korea. Not to cut you off, but the South Korean president has been briefed on updated plans to assassinate Kim Jong-un. So that's on the menu as well.
So would that be, let's talk about that then. So let's say that South Korea or somebody finds a way to assassinate Kim Jong-un.
Right.
Does that make things better? What's the succession plan in North Korea? Are there rational people in the North Korean government, and is Kim Jong-un just the wacko guy, or what would happen?
I was actually, Kim Jong-un is rational in his way, in terms of he wants to survive, he wants power. The question is, how much does he really want to kind of push this further? And some argue that he actually wants to unite the Korean Peninsula, which would necessitate a war, obviously. But, you know, who knows? I doubt there's a clear succession plan. And the reason why is that dictators tend not to create them. Because if you have a succession plan, it tells everyone else, hey, if you take me out, you get this other person.
This guy's in charge then.
Right. So dictators tend not to talk a whole lot about what's going to happen afterwards. They just, you know, let things kind of go their own way. You know, maybe appoint one of their children to be their successor. But even that's kind of risky because people start saying, huh, maybe the son will be better than the father.
Yeah.
Maybe we should overthrow the father. And the son's like, maybe I want to be in charge now. So I doubt there is a real succession plan, but it could be a situation where it's not quite a dead hand switch where things happen automatically. But again, taking out a foreign leader, if someone took out our foreign leader, it'd be an act of war.
Right. And that's always the ethical and moral and political question is what right does any country have, us or anybody else, of A, killing somebody, and B, of killing somebody's leader?
Also, leaders tend not to like to go down that road because once you start killing leaders, it can always come back at you. So, I mean, yes, we did try to kill Castro many times. But that was kind of an exception to the rule. We never
But we have, as a nation, we've killed a bunch of
absolutely
of people, and we've helped elect, quote unquote, elect people
and
over the decades.
Absolutely. But there are some lines that leaders tend not to cross except in extreme circumstances, and this is, you know, for South Korea, they were talking about this in terms of if things really started getting out of control, then this might be an option. But the South Koreans are actually, you know, starting to really think about their defense now because they don't see a path forward with North Korea towards some kind of reducing of tensions. So that could also escalate and create a kind of a security spiral between the North and the South. So,
Do we have any information on the people of North Korea? What is their status other than they live and they wake up and they breathe oxygen every day? I mean, is there can be no opposition in North Korea?
No.
Is there?
No. I mean, any opposition would have to come from generals. And even that case, Kim Jong-un has been very, very good at weeding his garden. I doubt there's anyone who's really serious about, you know, potentially overthrowing him. So we have to live with the situation. And talking is, as Donald Trump says, not the answer, but it's also the answer at the same time. I think what we have to do, and this is going to be painful for us, is to accept the fact that North Korea, this idea that we can roll back North Korea's nuclear program, that ain't ever going to happen. That's not going to happen. So we have to accept it and then move on from there. Politics is the art of the possible, and you can't go for things that are impossible.
Thomas Ambrosio, NDSU, with us. If you want to join the conversation, you certainly can. Talk about North Korea or anything else. We have some other stuff on the table as well. 293-9000, or you can email us talk@wday.com. Take a pause, come back. More with Thomas Ambrosio next on the Mike McFeely Show. If I had a rocket launcher, if I had a rocket launcher, I would not hesitate. Welcome back to the Mike McFeely Show, 970 WDAY, 93.1 FM on a Wednesday, 922. That means Thomas Ambrosio, NDSU, is in studio with us. You're probably swimming because the kids are back in school now, right?
Yeah, things have been kind of crazy.
Like the college students, kids, but
A week and a half done with the first week and a half done. And things are already kind of picking up. So classes, and it's great. I mean, I like being in class. It's fun, and it's good to have the students back. But it certainly creates a kind of this madness, especially early on. Then you start settling into a routine, and then things become much more calm.
What do you like most about your job as a college? Do you like the teaching aspect? Do you like being in the classroom? Do you like research? Do you like papers? Do you like what do you like?
I would say it's kind of split between research and teaching. Over the summer, it's like, oh, I love just doing research. But I like being in the classroom, too. It's fun. I mean, I learn stuff, too. So when I'm teaching a class in international law and I get a new textbook, I'm learning it along with the students in some ways. One hopes that I know a little more than they do. But, I get to learn it, too. And topics are interesting. And it kind of keeps me nimble, at least mentally. And, I'm teaching intro to political science. And it's fun kind of teaching the... here's how we think about political science and ways to think like politicians, or not politicians, but like political scientists do,
yeah,
kind of more theoretically. So we did an exercise where I wrote up concepts of why the 2016 election turned out the way it did. But it wasn't like specifics. It was more like identity politics or reputation of candidates, things of that nature, or the role of the media, to try to get students to think at a more abstract level than just kind of the day-to-day emotions of an election. So that was kind of fun, kind of getting them to kind of think of politics a little bit differently, which is what I try to do in intro to political science.
I may have asked you this question already, but I'll ask it again. Is you teach intro classes and you also teach more advanced, whatever, right. 400 level.
I always have the two, right, intro class and then a 400 level class.
So which do you prefer? Because I as a non-teacher, I could see that it'd be fun to see the light bulb go on for some 18-year-old, but it would also be fun to work with the higher level students who are far more advanced in their thinking and in what they're doing.
Right. I think it is. Yeah. I mean, both of them do have their charms to it. I actually, in some ways, I like teaching the intro classes better in the sense that there's kind of, you're really truly introducing someone to something.
Yeah.
And a way of thinking they haven't thought about before. Thinking about their ba-boom. Thinking about, you know, not like how the government works, say the U.S. government works, but the thinking behind how it works and why was it constructed this way. I really like teaching that. But then again, I like teaching the international law class in particular. I have a whole section on the intersection between international law and U.S. law and how the two, you know, dealing with U.S. treaties mm-hmm. and the role of international law within the U.S. courts. And I really enjoy that. That's like my favorite part of the everything I teach during both semesters okay, is that
cool.
part. So,
cool.
yeah.
Okay.
It's kind of fun.
Yeah. I think yeah. teaching would be fun. Okay. Just a few minutes left.
Sure.
Russia.
Yes, our friends.
Is Russia, did you say they're doing some military exercises? Or that's
next
gonna
month?
Come up? Okay.
Yeah,
so what does that mean?
Yeah,
what are we doing here?
The Russians, always, I almost said Soviets, Freudian slip there. The Russians always have military exercises. We do too. But they're doing a really large-scale one called Zapad, which means west in Russia. And what's interesting about this is that it's a very large exercise that's taking place primarily on the territory of Belarus, which is wasn't one of the former Soviet countries and was called the last dictatorship in Europe before Putin took control over Russia. And Belarus has had kind of has played this dance with Russia where it's allied with Russia, but then kind of shifts a little bit to the west to try to get some resources out of Russia. And it kind of has been playing this game for like two decades now, where they're trying to play kind of both sides against each other, kind of flirting with the west and flirting with Russia. But there's some thought that this, you know, at least in conspiracy theories, that this exercise may be a prelude to a Russian takeover or overthrow of the president of Belarus. Called Alexander Lukashenko, who has one of the greatest mustaches on the planet.
Well, now I got to Google it, so keep on talking.
You have to Google. He has a little, like, 7 or 8-year-old son, and he dresses in identical uniforms, too.
Oh,
he keeps saying he's my successor.
Wow.
Talking about successors, you have an 8-year-old or 10-year-old now. But, this is part of, you know, this exercise taking place in kind of a combustible period, at least rhetorically, between the U.S. and Russia. And in fact, at the last NATO summit, the NATO countries talked about the two greatest threats to NATO, which is terrorism and Russia, kind of not quite equating the two, but kind of linking them together. And the Russians did not like that at all. So relationship between the U.S. and Russia, it continues to be poor. And this, you know, military exercises under normal conditions, no one worries about. But now we're in a situation in which countries are worried about Russia. I don't think Russia is going to do anything maybe in Belarus, certainly not towards NATO, but it does show how the relationship has changed fundamentally after 2014, when no one thought Russia would annex the territory of its neighbor, and it did.
I don't think the mustache is that, it's not that impressive of Lukashenko. I mean, it's not like a big, I was expecting like a big curly Q.
Oh, no. This is a...
It's a very tight, very, you know...
It's a very Soviet mustache.
Yes.
It's very...
And here's a photo of Lukashenko with Steven Seagal. So, I mean,
they're friends with each other.
He's hanging out with Steven Seagal.
Yeah, actually, Steven Seagal is like friends with Lukashenko and with Putin. Steven Seagal seen better days, but
well, yes,
he certainly has.
Wow.
But there was a picture of him. I don't know. It's a picture you're looking at as one of him eating a carrot.
No. I'm just. Okay. I see a picture of Seagal with like really black dyed hair, maybe fake hair, and a little like orange sunglasses on with Lukashenko.
Yep. Yeah.
Fantastic.
You know, some people like dictators. You know, it's like
I guess.
Rodman hanging out with Kim Jong-un.
Oh, good Lord. Yeah,
maybe he should be our ambassador that. If we reestablish diplomatic relations.
Envoy, North Korean envoy, Dennis Rodman.
Stranger things have happened. Reality stars can become president.
Oh,
reality
don't,
star
don't
basketball player
me.
Can become an ambassador.
Don't remind me. All right, well, that's it.
All
We're
right.
out of time, man.
Sounds good.
Thank you, Thomas Ambrosio, NDSU, on the Mike McFeely Show for his weekly visit. We'll take a pause. Dick Bramer at 10:05. We'll talk some Twins baseball. But before that, got to talk a little about the Graywind story. Eric Johnson brought up something interesting to me during the last break. I want to throw it at you. We'll do that next. Very controversial on the Mike McFeely Show. 970 WDAY 93.1 FM. Did you load a bunch of new sounds onto my sound machine here, Dave?
Yeah, you got about 5 or 6 new ones.
Let's see, which ones don't I recognize? Here's one I don't recognize. What's this one?
That's right! We can't have anyone freak out there, okay? We've got to keep our composure! We've come too far! There's too much to lose! We've got to keep our composure!
Little Will Ferrell action there?
Nice.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I like that.
There's a new one.
I like to do that.
I meant to do that.
I don't know who that is. Who's that?
That's Paul Rubens, otherwise known as Pee Wee Herman.
Oh, jeez.
I meant
Pee-wee
to do
Herman
that.
Herman on here?
Hey, bada 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 so wing bada. Hey, bada 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 so wing bada. Kennedy, so wing bada.
What's that from?
Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Oh, yeah.
You went to Wrigley Field?
Yeah, went to Wrigley Field.
Personally, I think we got hosed on that call.
Oh, yes, Bob Uecker.
Classic.
That's very, very classic. Is that it?
I think there's one more, another Uecker in there.
Let's see if I can find it.
Playoffs?
No, that's not it.
Playoffs? You kidding me? Playoffs?
You have made me very angry. Very angry indeed.
Well, that's the little guy, this little alien guy.
Marvin
from
the Martian.
Bugs Bunny, Marvin the Martian.
Just a bit outside.
There we go. That's it. Nice job. I hear Kolpak and Izzo found this on Saturday. I didn't get a chance to listen because I was busy doing some other stuff, but I found that they found the sound machine on Saturday.
I can't believe they figured it out.
Well, it's advanced technology, certainly.
Push and play.
For those guys. Yeah, it's really, really difficult. It's
was the turnover margin, Mike?
That's the one they like the best right there. That's the one they like the best. Email comes in to the program and says, very admirable of you to not be political during Hurricane Harvey. After all, you took your political shots at Trump last week before a drop of rain had hit the ground in Texas. You seem forgetful or maybe just phony. No, I did not take political shots at Trump last week as it relates to Hurricane Harvey. So you are completely inaccurate with your obsessive dislike of me. What I said last week is basically what I said today when it comes to Hurricane Harvey and the president. I said last week, I hope Trump does a great job. I wasn't confident that he was going to do that. I said, I don't believe that he has it in him to do it, but I hope he does a great job because that means that he will have played his role as president and FEMA and Homeland Security and all these other departments of the federal government that have to get involved with this disaster will run like a well-oiled machine. I want him to do well in this situation.
People's lives are at stake.
Yes, and that's what it's all about. As I said a few minutes ago, is if the president does well, in his response to Hurricane Harvey. That means the poor people whose houses are under 5 feet of water will do well too. I just don't have the confidence that he's going to do that. And I'm not going to take shots. But his little speech yesterday was a little strange. And the fact that he didn't actually go anywhere near the disaster yesterday was a little strange. But that's, I mean, I'm not going to take shots. Okay? Not going to go down that road. 2939000, 888-970-9329. Or you can email us talk@wday.com. We haven't talked at all today about the Savannah Graywind murder. And we're kind of in a wait-and-see mode or a holding pattern, I think, in some ways. We learned yesterday that the preliminary autopsy report had been released. And in it, just the very basic information was released that Savannah Graywind was the victim of homicidal violence. Okay? And I think that we all knew that was going to happen, but it was made official yesterday by the Ramsey County Medical Examiner's Office. I caught just a fraction of Jay's show yesterday afternoon, and he touched on it a little bit. And Eric Johnson and I were having a discussion during a previous break about this topic. Not so much the homicidal violence part of it, because we knew that was going to happen. But at some point during this process, the full autopsy is going to be released. Now, it's going to be some time. It's not going to be overnight. These things take time. It might be weeks. It might be months until the full autopsy report is released. And when it is released, presumably, there is going to be some grisly things in the autopsy, as there is, frankly, for every autopsy when a murder is involved. I mean, there's no pretty murders. But given the circumstances of what we know, what we think we know, and given the fact that Savannah Graywind was this young 22-year-old woman who apparently was lured by a couple of people into an awful, horrific situation that ended with her death, I think that everybody is a little bit queasy already about what might be found in the autopsy. And we're making assumptions, but I think that we kind of know what happened in some way, shape, or form. And so the question is being raised, and this is the question that Eric raised to me, because he's been getting some of this feedback and this pushback already from people, is how much do you want to know about the nitty-gritty details? And how much should the media release and report on when it comes to the nitty-gritty details of Savannah Graywind's autopsy? And Eric framed it that he's already getting people saying, you know, hey, whoa, you know, we don't want to know. You know, you guys, you media guys have to put the brakes on this. You don't need to report every little, you know, grisly detail of the autopsy. We don't want to know exactly what happened to Savannah and how exactly she died. And oh, by the way, it's going to be very disrespectful to her family and her friends if you in the media report all these terrible details of the autopsy. Presuming again that the details are grisly, which again, all murders are grisly, but this one seems to have a different level to it. My response to that is, as ugly as it might be, and as nasty as we think some of this might be when it comes to the autopsy report and giving details of what might have happened to Savannah Graywind at the hands of these two people, it is our job, first of all, in the media, at the forum, it is a journalist's job to report factual information about important stories. And so if people are already trying to put up this barrier that, you know, don't do it, don't release this information, don't print it, don't talk about it, don't have it on TV, that's not going to happen. And I don't say that with any arrogance or whatever the term might be. Part of the news media's job is to report factual information from important stories. Whether or not that information is good information or bad information or negative information or grisly information.
It's basically you're just reporting the truth. You're not making not going to make anything
up. No, we're not.
This is what happened.
No, we're not making anything up. Nope. It's when the autopsy report comes out, we will report what is in the autopsy. Period.
You have to know. Because this is our community. We need to know all this stuff. It's the truth. We need to know.
That is true. The other thing to keep in mind, folks, if you're already lining up to bash the media, is it's going to come out at the trial as well. It's going to be in a public setting. Whatever happened to Savannah Graywind is going to come up in the trial of these two people who have been accused of kidnapping and murder.
Yeah, you can't pretend that this doesn't happen.
You can't pretend it didn't happen. As ugly as it might be, as nasty as it might be, as disturbing as it might be, it's going to come out. Remember, and we keep drawing parallels between the Drew Shadeen case and this case, and I don't know that that's fair. What's fair is that two young women lost their lives in horrible situations. But the details of Drew Shadeen's death came out. The autopsy report was made public, as it should be, and we, the media, reported the details of Drew Shadeen's death as we need to, as we are obligated to. It wasn't sensationalized. It wasn't with any joy. It wasn't with any pleasure. But it was important to find out what happened to Drew Shadeen. The same way it's going to be important to find out what happened to Savannah Graywind. I'm going to take a pause. There's a couple phone calls hanging on. Teresa, others, stick with me through the break. I'll get to you as quick as I can, but I'm late against a break here. 293-9000, 888-970-9329, or you can email us talk@wday.com. My Boat Radio Waves is sponsored by Bottle Barn Liquors, Jordal Custom Homes, Windows Plus, Hard Lakes Meats in Pelican Rapids, Dave Noah of Remax Legacy, and FM Water Systems. This is the Mike McFeely Show. Let's go right to the phone lines. Teresa, I believe, wants to weigh in on what we're talking about the autopsy report that's eventually going to come out in detail regarding the Savannah Graywind murder. Teresa, you have the stage, my friend. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, it would be nice to know some of the news, but could we have a spoiler alert so that we could turn our radio down as we choose and then filter it through ourselves as the details come about?
Yeah, I mean, I think that whenever it happens, and again, it's not going to be for a while, I think you could assume that at the top of the hour news on every radio station in town and on the 6 o'clock and 10 o'clock news and in the paper and everywhere else, that the details are going to be there. So I have no problem with people deciding on your own, Teresa, that you don't want to see the details. That's perfectly fine. I understand that. My point is that I don't think that the media should be expected to not report the news.
Yeah, that's the hard part about it. It's the saddest thing, but yes, it's like you guys, it does have to be reported.
Yeah. So, Teresa, thank you. Thanks for the... I'm not saying people have to be interested in it. I'm not saying people have to consume it. You have every right, as with every other story that comes out, to either read it, listen to it, see it, or not. I mean, that's perfectly fair. We do that every day. And I will... This doesn't compare... I'm not trying to compare these two things, but I'm trying to come up with a quick... analogy in my own life. ESPN years ago got into the habit of showing injuries, right? Because everything now is on TV or everything is videotaped. And so ESPN many years ago got in the habit of showing guys' knees buckling or showing guys' ankles rolling over.
The Joe Theismann.
Yeah, exactly. There was a story a few years ago about some basketball player got his eye plucked out of its socket because the guy playing defense kind of swiped at him with his hand. His finger got caught and popped the guy's eye out of his socket. When that first started happening, I'd be watching ESPN and go, okay, and then I'd see the injuries. I stopped doing it after about two times. I don't know if there's newsworthiness, frankly, in showing injuries, you know, gruesome type injuries, other than it's just the gruesome factor. And so I just stopped watching them. Whenever I see, you know, a video on online or, you know, ESPN says, well, we're going to show you a video now of Teddy Bridgewater's knee injury. I just turn the channel or I look away or I don't want to see that.
Yeah, because then they're going to go into slow motion and you can see here where it.
Right. It doesn't interest me and I don't watch it. And that's a choice I make. And I'm not comparing that to what happened here in Fargo. But my point is that we all can make the decision to watch something or not watch something or read something or not read something. And there's going to be a lot of people who choose, as Teresa, it sounds like, is going to do, to choose to not find out specifically what happened to Savannah Graywind. And that's just fine.
Yeah, I think she was like looking like almost like a rated, this story is rated R. You know, it's like kind of like a disclaimer almost.
Yep, and sure. And that's fair. I mean,
you're reading the morning paper and all of a sudden, oh my God.
Well, right, but the more, you know, if you still get the form delivered, you're going to be able to see the headline that says, you know, Graywind
murdered,
you know, autopsy released or whatever, and you're going to choose to not read the story. And as I said, if you're listening to WDAY radio, you're going to know that day that at the top and bottom of every hour, there's going to be some details about the way she died. But I don't think it's correct to put that on us, the media. Now how we play it, absolutely. I mean, you know, if we are sensationalizing, then blast away, absolutely, then rip us apart. But simply reporting the autopsy is not sensationalizing. That's just reporting factual information. But if you all of a sudden have a lead-in saying, you know, Rob, next, the gruesome details of, you know, then that's wrong. And then we should get blasted for that. But just reporting an autopsy, not sensationalizing. Dick Bramer, we can sensationalize Twins baseball because they deserve it. He's up next on 970.
A drive to right field. And he has another one against the White Sox. A drive to left. Garcia back. Gone! He's over from both sides of the plate.
How about that Jorge Polanco? Home runs from both sides of the plate.
Coming along.
It's remarkable what's happening to the Minnesota Twins down the stretch here. They're getting heroics from a number of different places. Some of them, frankly, unexpected just several weeks ago. But the Twins beat the White Sox last night at Target Field 6-4. They maintain a one-game lead for the second wild card spot. They're only 2.5 behind the Yankees for the first wild card spot, and there's still a month left in the season. This isn't over in any way, shape, or form for anything when it comes to the Twins making the playoffs as a wild card. Dick Bramer joins us now on the Mike McFeely Show to talk Twins baseball, courtesy of Jefferson Lines. Good morning, sir. You're probably walking on air these last couple of weeks because the Twins are they're just so interesting. They're just fun to watch.
Yeah, this is what we've been waiting for, isn't it? Through this long drought that the Twins fans have had to endure. A team that's playing good baseball. You mentioned the unlikely sources. I mean, the guys that are getting it done are all 23, 24, 25 years old, so they're entering their prime years. The Twins are going to have them for a while. This is what we've been waiting for, and we don't know how it's going to end, but it sure is a fun ride, that's for sure.
Well, and that's, I think that's what has people, Twins fans, sports fans, around Fargo-Moorhead for sure, particularly excited, is even if the Twins don't make the playoffs this year, the future now looks so much more brighter than it did just last year or a couple of years ago, that this might just be the beginning of something, and that's what has people really excited.
Yeah, and it turns out the baseball scouts and the experts who projected great things for these young players that were in the Twin system, let's tip our caps to them because it looks like they were right. It looks like Byron Buxton is on the verge of a stardom. It looks like Eddie Rosario is going to be a really productive hitter. Polanco can play at short. He had a wonderful game last night apart from the home runs. He made, you know, some great plays in the field. And this is all being done without, the dominant Twins player in the first 4 months of the year, Miguel Sano. And they're running the table on teams. It's really been something to watch.
Speaking of Sano, as long as you brought his name up, what is his status? Because he had it was not a stress fracture. It was like a pre-stress fracture in his leg. Is he going to play anytime soon?
I don't think anytime soon because he hasn't done any baseball activities. He's done some, cardio work to try to, keep in some sort of leg shape. But when the injury is to a leg, there's, limited stuff that you can do. My guess is that he is at least a week away and that when he comes back, he will be limited to DH duties. That's just my guess. I don't think, given the nature of the injury and how slow it's been to heal, I don't think the Twins would even entertain the idea of having him spend, an hour and a half standing at third base and moving around at third base when they have the luxury, if you will, of having a designated hitter who can, swing, hit home runs, whatever he's going to do, and then go sit down in the dugout, for 40 minutes or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I think Twins fans need to prepare themselves for the fact that when he does come back, I don't think he's going to be seeing much time at third base.
Dick Bramer, our guest on the Mike McFeely Show, if you want to join the conversation, talk some Twins baseball, ask a question, you certainly can. Give us a call, 293-9000, or email us talk@wday.com. Getting back to Polanco, homering from both sides of the plate, I was actually surprised. I read Lavelle's Neil's story this morning in the Star Tribune. He's like, Polanco's like the fifth Twin to homer from both sides of the plate in the same game. I thought it'd be a much more rare feat than that, but, Roy Smalley, Chili Davis, Kenneth Vargas, they've all done it. I guess I assumed it was a much more rare accomplishment than what it is.
Yeah, and it's all happened. Ryan Domet is the other one Twins for a couple of years, and it's all happened since 1986, and Roy Smalley, who I worked the telecast with last night, was the first guy to do it in 86. And we got into a little bit of a discussion how, the Twins have not had, a lot of great switch hitters, their history. Roy's the longest tenured one. Chili Davis was just playing for the Twins for a couple of years. Ryan Domet for a couple of years. Kenny Vargas might do it two or three more times before his career is over with. It is kind of a rare feat and a novelty. And nobody had done it in Twins history from 1961 to 1986.
Chili Davis, I hadn't heard that name in a while till I read Lavelle's story this morning. He was only around for a couple of years, but he was pretty good in those couple of years for the Twins. Chili Davis was a fun guy to watch, too, back in the day.
Yeah, he had his best year, maybe one of the best years of his career in 1991, and then really tailed off in 1992, and no one really understood why. He went on to play for a few more teams, and now he's the hitting coach for the Boston Red Sox. So we're able to keep in touch with him, of course, with spring training and the play that the Twins have with the Red Sox every year.
We seem to be talking more and more each week about Byron Buxton in a much more positive sense, clearly, than we were early in the season. But if you look at what Byron Buxton has done from, let's say, the middle of June, his numbers are outstanding, and it's much more noticeable now because the overall season numbers are coming up. But he's actually been very good for a while here, and we're just getting a glimpse of what he can do, Dick. This kid is unbelievably talented.
Well, I hope fans were able to watch most of the Toronto series, where Friday he got two bunt singles and looked like he was the fastest human on earth, and then hit three home runs on Sunday. I mean, what more do you want a guy to do? You know, he's so fast, he can beat out even a mediocre bunt, and then he plastered three home runs on three swings in Sunday's game. He, as we've talked about before, Mike, he's the most distracting player I've ever covered with the Twins, because I look forward to his at-bats, even when he was struggling. You knew that the potential was there for him to hit a ball down the line someplace and leg out a triple. I look forward to his at-bats. I think one thing that should really resonate with Twins fans is how many of his RBI hits, not the home runs, but the RBI hits, the singles, have come with two outs. He got a big one for the Twins last night in the first inning, and that's kind of been a hidden factor in his surge, the fact that he's really developed a good two-out approach where he's not trying to hit home runs. He's got a guy at second base. He's going to try to get a single up the middle, and that's exactly what he did last night.
Well, you talk about his hitting in Toronto, but how about the catch he made in center field in Toronto, the turnaround sprint straight back and dive over the shoulder on the warning track? I'm not sure I've ever seen a catch quite like that, because it just happened so fast. That was remarkable. And if people haven't seen the video of it, just search online, Google Buxton Toronto catch, and you'll see it was just a remarkable catch.
That was the first game of the series, and I talked with Byron before the game with the premise that he had played there last year, and he said, "No, I wasn't. I was in Rochester when the Twins were in Toronto last year." And of course, he was there for early batting practice on Friday. That's typical that the visiting team will have some extra batting practice to allow outfielders to get used to the environment out there in the outfield and the warning track and what parts of the wall are padded and all of that. And Byron said, "No, it's kind of a unusual surface because of the springy artificial turf." But he said, "I liked it." And then he went out and made that catch like the Rogers Center was his home ballpark. He knew where the wall was. He knew, he could make a dive like that without breaking his neck. It's amazing. He's got such great aptitude to learn about his environment, and we've seen that now in his hitting approach. We've said all along, even when he was hitting under 200, he's got, in terms of makeup and character, he's off the charts. And that's why it's so gratifying for Twins fans, I think. I believe they sense they know this guy a little bit, and they know how seriously he takes his work.
Dick Bramer, our guest on the Mike McFeely Show. We'll take a pause. We'll come back. We'll talk more with him about Twins baseball. And I'm going to ask Dick about Giancarlo Stanton. Maybe not getting a lot of play up here. We had a story in the paper, was it yesterday or today, about Giancarlo Stanton possibly surpassing 61 home runs. He'd be the first clean guy to surpass Roger Maris's record. And that is interesting, because I think many of us in this area still think that Roger Maris is the real home run record holder in a single season, because everybody above him was juicing. So we'll talk about all of that and much more with Dick Bramer next, courtesy of Jefferson Lines on the Mike McFeely Show. .1022 on the Mike McFeely Show, 970 WDAY, 93.1 FM. Dick Bramer with us, courtesy of Jefferson Lines, talking some Twins baseball. Our conversation's much more fun this year in late August and into September than they have been the past several years, and that's because the Twins are in the thick of the wild card race in the American League. Dick, the people are talking about the Twins going for that second wild card spot. They're only 2.5 back of the Yankees for the top wild card spot. That's not out of reach by any stretch of the imagination. And the Twins have a pretty favorable schedule here. They can make a run at the top wild card spot.
They sure can. And that's the talk amongst the players, is they're looking through the windshield. They're not looking in the rearview mirror at the Angels or the Orioles or the Mariners. They're targeting the Yankees. They've got three games left with them in New York. And then there are three games of intense interest in that with that theme here today. Yankees got rained out last night with Cleveland. They're playing an afternoon straight-up doubleheader. By the time the Twins throw first pitch tonight, they'll know the outcome of the doubleheader. And if by chance the Indians, who are playing really good baseball right now, if they were to sweep the Yankees and the Twins took care of their game tonight, they'd be just a game behind New York. And again, with those three games coming up in New York later on in September, I don't know how to it would be preferable, of course, in a one-game format to play the game at home. But the way the Twins have played at the on the road and their history in playoff series at Yankee Stadium, they've had better luck at Yankee Stadium than they have at home.
Yeah, but you got to get the home game if you have the opportunity because you want the last at bat, of course. But I am hoping if the Twins make the playoffs that it's the Yankees at Target Field, because even though I'm a neutral sports writer guy and I'm a journalist and all these other things, I hate the New York Yankees with a passion. I was born to a father who hated the New York Yankees. I hate the New York Yankees. I want the Twins to beat the Yankees in a one-game series and finally end their season. That would be perfect for this year for me.
Well, and I've related it when the Yankees have had their success against the Twins in the postseason. If it ever happens, it'll feel every bit as good as it did in Kansas City when they finally beat the Yankees. They had the same issue in the late 70s, and finally in the 1980 playoffs, they beat the Yankees and went on to the World Series. And I happened to be there. A good friend of mine played for the Royals back then, and I can tell you how much of a relief it was for the Royals. They lost the World Series, but it was a tremendous victory for the Kansas City region because they finally beat the Yankees, and I suspect the same reaction would be held here if that were to happen.
Is there any regret at all on the Twins from the front office or from field staff that they made the trades they did at the deadline? Because at that time, it certainly looked like the Twins were dead, that they were waving the white flag. So they got rid of Jaime Garcia. They traded away their closer, Brandon Kinsler. Any hint of regret, especially with Garcia, because you can always use starting pitching and the Twins could use another starting pitcher as always for the stretch run.
Yeah, I think to be honest with you, Mike, there's probably more regret regarding Kinsler because he was an all-star closer. And Garcia, he's with the Yankees. He's pitching to an ERA of almost 6. That ballpark is not going to suit him well, and he's pitching the first game today at Yankee Stadium against the Indians. He's not pitched well at all since going to New York. But with Kinsler, a guy who, you know, made the all-star team as a closer, meant an awful lot to the function of the bullpen, I think that's the one that they probably do regret. I walked out after the ball game last night with Thad Levine and Derek Falvey, and we talked about some other things, but I'm guessing they probably would admit to you that given what they know now, they wish they had not traded Kinsler. But as it is, you know, the combo at the end, Hildenberger, Rogers, and Belisle, they've you know, gotten the job done pretty well.
Yeah, I don't think you can blame them for what they did at the trading deadline because, as we've said, the Twins were on a bad skid, and they just did not look like they were going to make any kind of run and that the early season optimism was going to fade away. I don't think there's blame to be assigned, but, in retrospect, now that things are clicking, they could certainly use those guys. Hey, before we go, I got to ask you this, a non-Twins related question. Giancarlo Stanton, Miami Marlins slugger, has 51 home runs. Great hitter. He is in sight of our guy, Roger Maris. Roger Maris, of course, Fargo's guy, hit 61 home runs in 1961. Yeah, call me a homer, but I've always thought that Maris is 61 is still the real record in baseball because the guys who beat it were all juicing. What do you make of Giancarlo Stanton and what he's doing? And do you, as a baseball fan, you know, how do you view the home run record? I know the record's the record, but how do you have an outlook on that?
Well, I agree with you 100%. For me, 61 is still the number. But who cares what you think or what I think? The important thing is what Giancarlo Stanton said about a week and a half ago when he said he considered 61 to be the mark. And this is a guy who had Barry Bonds as his hitting coach last year. So I think for, you know, baseball purists and maybe there are fewer of us around than there used to be, but for baseball purists, 61 is still the number. And I don't know how to feel about Stanton's eventual or possible passing of Maris's mark. I suspect, and I only got a chance to meet Roger once, I suspect he would have approved someone like Stanton eclipsing his record because of, you know, the type of guy that he is. And I don't know Stanton very well, but everything I read about him and hear about him, he's an upstanding, you know, good guy, and he's on a tremendous run. He, you know, we thought Dozier was on a tear last mm-hmm. year in August, and this guy's taking it one better.
Well, I wrote a little bit about it on my blog last week or a couple weeks ago, I think, but using Stanton's remarks that he thought 61 was the real record. But if you look at that number 61, nobody has beat it who has been clean. I mean, it's Bonds, McGuire, right. And Sosa, and that record still stands, in my view, for all these years, because nobody has even come particularly close to it who's been clean. I mean, it's unbelievable how good that record is.
25 years ago, we had gone a long time before anyone had ever hit 50. I think Cecil Fielder broke the 50 home run barrier. And just getting to 50 was considered a huge accomplishment. Harmon never did it.
Harmon Killebrew never got to 50.
49 three times.
Yep, exactly. Dick, thank you. Great stuff as always. We're all enjoying the broadcasts because the Twins are doing well, and you guys are doing a great job bringing them to us. So keep it up, and we'll talk next week again, okay?
You got it, Mike.
You bet. Dick Bramer with us on Wednesdays, courtesy of Jefferson Lines on the Mike McFeely Show. 61 is the record.
Legitimate.
You all know me to not be a homer for all things Fargo, but 61 is the record. If Stanton beats it, he beats it. Good for him. At least it'll go down to somebody who's not sticking a needle in their arm. Sixty-one home runs,
the legitimate home run king.
So here's the question, then: I wonder if folks around here want to see Stanton not break 61, because Giancarlo Stanton is at 51 home runs right now. He has an entire month left of the season, and he has been hot. I mean, unbelievably hot. So there's no reason to believe that in the next 30 days. That he's not going to hit 10 home runs. I guess he'd have to hit 11 to get to 62. So does it matter anymore to people around here? Because back in 98, I think everybody was hoping against hope that McGuire and Sosa were not going to break the record.
ESPN went overboard on that bad boy.
That was the story, though, 20 years ago. That was it.
But their heads were the size of watermelons.
Huge story. I went down to St. Louis. I went down to St. Louis in late August, or was it late September? I think McGuire got to 70 home runs that year, so they surpassed 61 fairly early, I think, in either September or late August. I'll have to look it up. But
him and Sosa were going back and forth.
Him and Sosa were neck and neck for most of the season. And there was some question about who was going to get there first. But it just so happened the timing was that the Cubs played at St. Louis, Sosa, McGuire, quote unquote, against each other. And they both had like 59 home runs, or Sosa had 58, McGuire had 59.
That's probably why it seemed like a bigger deal.
Something like that. And it was. It was something else. I flew down to St. Louis to cover that, and it was unlike anything I'd ever seen before, been a part of before. And because it had happened so early in the season, I think there was a tinge of inevitability for Roger Maris fans back here. And it was really kind of neat at the time. Because we didn't know that McGuire and Sosa were both juicing, and McGuire did all the right things and said all the right things, and I think after he hit number 62, He went up into the stands, I think, in St. Louis. Roger Maris's family was there. And, you know, McGuire went up into the stands and hugged them, and it was all touchy-feely. And at the time, it was terrific. At the time, it was fantastic. And, of course, we learned later that it was all a fraud because McGuire, Sosa, and then eventually Barry Bonds, it was discovered, either had been implicated in taking steroids or had just, you know, were known to take steroids. And so
Well, the juice factor, I mean, it's just like they're a bunch of cheaters, you know, anything to win, anything to get ahead.
Well, and baseball was complicit back then too. They, you know, the baseball was really promoting the home run, and that was after the strike that wiped out the season.
Yeah, they tried to put on a brave
face. And they put on a, you know, the chicks dig the long ball, and all, it was all based on home runs, getting fans back, and it worked. In 98, baseball was at a peak because of McGuire and Sosa. But Bonds hit 73, I think, in 2001, and nobody has come even close to that, which, you know, there are people who say, well, hey, you know, steroids don't help you hit home runs. But then how else do you explain that Barry Bonds hit 73 home runs in a year and nobody in the last 16 years has come even close to that?
Maybe there was a corked bat.
And McGuire hit 70 in 98 and nobody has come close to that. And the only three guys who have hit more than 61 home runs were all on steroids. So you can't tell me that it didn't help them in one way, shape, or form, whether it was in just pure strength or whether it was in recovery that they didn't get worn down late in the season. Something happened with steroids and home runs because the link is obvious that, yeah. Maris was the only, you know.
For how many years was the record intact?
61 till 98. So and
then all of a sudden you have like three of them.
Then all of a sudden you have just a number of guys go ballistic over.
Whose heads are the size of Utah.
Right, over the course of.
What is?
That's big. Over the course of 3 years, you have three guys go bonkers and hit home runs. And then, since they cleaned up the sport and started drug testing, nobody's even come close to 60, I don't think. I think Ryan Howard got 57 one year or something for the Phillies. I mean, so come on.
Yeah. I mean, the steroids were getting ridiculous. It was like stick 'em in the NFL. It was everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. Fred Biletnikoff. Remember those guys with the Raiders? So to me, it's, you know, if Stanton breaks the record, he breaks the record. It's, you know.
And he's clean, right?
As far as we know, yes. Because they do drug testing now in baseball. And so I think it would be very difficult to be doing steroids these days. And guys do get caught. Every once in a while, you'll hear that somebody
trying to cheat,
you know, right, gets suspended for PEDs. But, you know, if the guy breaks the record,
good for him.
Good for him. It's
and he could be the legitimate. Then I want him to talk to Roger's family, not McGuire. And I held his and I held his bat and I cried. And remember that old quote from McGuire?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because he touched his bat before the game. And
jeez,
but it was something. And
I know, but it wasn't legitimate.
No, I know, but at the time. That was the biggest story that I'd ever personally covered, because to be in Busch Stadium and just to see, I mean, it was an international story. There were, you know, dozens and dozens of reporters. This is back, you know, in the days when newspapers were still going great guns, they're at their peak, but there was every national reporter, every national TV station, ESPN, radio.
Japan.
Oh, it was like nothing I'd ever seen before. And then when McGuire hit number 61 to tie the record, Busch Stadium just about came down. And then he hit the 62, I think, the next day, and it was just unreal. It was just, you know, something else that you would never have experienced otherwise. It was just astounding to be in the stadium. I was standing about in an aisle about 20 rows behind home plate when McGuire hit 62. And it was just a line drive left field. It wasn't a high towering.
It was a rope.
Shot. It was a rope that just went out really quickly. And then the place just went crazy.
They stopped the game for like, what, 10 minutes or so?
Yeah, it was unbelievable. Yeah, it was something. Then they went up in the stands and did all that stuff. It was, But it was, as it turns out, it was all dirty.
Cheater.
None of it mattered. I mean, it was just, it was, but what Giancarlo Stanton said last week was 61 is still the number, but the record is the record. The record in the books is 73 by Barry Bonds. So the record is what the record is, and I'm not going to get to 73, but 61 is still the number for me.
Ain't my record.
No. And there's still a billboard up, I think, on Main Avenue, Newman Signs.
Legitimate.
Still has that the legitimate home run king is 61.
I send that to all my baseball friends every year. Yeah, they just absolutely. Get mad.
Absolutely. It is 10:47 on the Mike McFeely Show, 293-9000, 888-970-9329. You can email us talk@wday.com. My boat radio waves, still not, by the way, repaired. The trailer's still not repaired. There's still no fender. Didn't get it. Got busy yesterday. Couldn't get it to
gonna be
get
one of those
stuff done.
Imported expensive fenders.
Oh, goodness gracious. Radio Wave sponsored by Hard Lakes Meats, Dave Noah of Remax Legacy, FM Water Systems, Windows Plus, Jordal Custom Homes, and Bottle Barn Liquors. Come back and wrap things up. Find out what's coming up on Midday Live next. Email comes into the program and says, hey, I must have missed it. What happened to Radio Waves? First of all, you have to listen all the time to this show because you never know what you might miss if you're not listening. I mean, once you lock it in on 90, 70 or 93.1, just tear off the dial. If there was a dial on vehicles, which there isn't.
It's more of a button.
Yeah, it's kind of a button. Yeah, you know,
touch screen.
It's like I got... Touchscreen, yeah. What happened to Radio Waves was nothing major. I blew out a trailer tire on the drive back from Devil's Lake on Sunday.
Tire took out the fender?
Tire pretty much, it didn't blow up, but it certainly came apart in pieces. And that blew off the fender, the plastic fender on my boat trailer, and led to many, many words being spewed in...
Yosemite said.
I think it's Ramsey County, that part of the state. Many, many words being spewed along Highway 2 in North Dakota. And I haven't had a chance to bring the trailer in yet. I may not have to bring it in. I can just probably order a fender from Ray's Marine.
Get Calvin to put it on. He might.
He was very excited, like I said. Very excited.
You got your own pit crew
to
now.
Change a tire. And so that's what happened to Radio Waves. It's not a big deal. Everything's fine, but it's still waterworthy. I just need a new trailer fender. So that's all it is. No big deal. I got ripped yesterday because I said I was going to bring it in to Ray's, and then some guy right away says, "Wait, you can't even put on your own fender?" Whoa, settle down, everybody.
This might be one of those very antique fenders.
Well.
It's one of those Tiffany fenders.
I think I've had the boat, I think, for, I want to say like 7 years now.
So it is vintage.
So it's getting up there. So, I'm sure there's a part somewhere that fits, but I'll have to check it out.
Is color an option?
Black is the only option I have. It's the only option I want on this situation.
Trying to be consistent.
You know what it might do? Maybe it'll lead me to getting a new boat. Maybe I'll just have to trade this one in.
Upgrade?
And get a different boat. Because, I mean, you don't want to have like a fender that's all, you know, mismatching.
Exactly. On the trailer.
On a trailer.
So you might as well get the 53-foot yacht.
One fender's going to look brand new. The other fender's going to look old. So, yeah. I mean, you can't have that.
It's just not proportional.
So I have to come up with this pitch to my wife and say, you know what I should do is I should trade in this boat and get a different one.
Maybe after that and get some nachos.
my wife... Was that you that mentioned?
Yesterday, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That my wife became like the most popular person in the world because I tweeted out that our conversation on Saturday, which was, you know, I said, what are we going to do today? And Michelle says, we're going to watch Jacksonville State against Tennessee Chattanooga and make some nachos. And I went, oh, God, I love you.
It's a perfect story.
It's fantastic. So many guys were jealous of me at that point.
Hello, I'm
one. You know, yep. Like, your wife does that? Yeah, absolutely.
Makes nachos?
She loves.
And football?
Email says, Mike, fenders are a two-beer operation. You'll be fine. But I like getting a new boat idea. Yeah, this one's paid off, though. There's no payments. I like it. I know everything about it. It's the perfect size boat. It's all I need. Everything is fine. It's all the latest technology that I can handle. It's all just, I don't need to go through a whole new breaking in process for a new boat over a stupid fender.
Maybe we could paint it, put some flames on it, make it fast on the water.
It's fast enough.
I don't know.
It's a 115 horse. So that's all I need. It's far more. You have to realize the boat I had prior to this one was a 16-foot Alumacraft with a 30 horse on it. So this is a, 17-foot, 9-inch Lund with 115 horse Mercury on it. Not a huge boat, not even a big boat by today's standards.
But a great upgrade.
But a huge upgrade. The other boat, I bought it, like 1990. I had it for 25 years. I mean, so.
It's a good life.
That's not bad. I mean, that's a pretty good $5,000 I spent. When I was, 25 years old. That's not bad. If every other $5,000 chunk I've spent in my life turned out to be as productive as my old boat, I would be in a much better place in life right now. Oh, sadly, I've spent...
Wouldn't we all?
Yeah.
Wouldn't we all?
And if I could have back all the money I spent on beer at the wharf in Alexandria, I'd be retired. I'd be in my boat right now. I wouldn't be working.
All that money we spent at the Trader and Trapper? I want it back. Back.
I spent far more at the wharf for some reason in Alexandria. Good Lord, I spent a lot of money there. I look back on that and go, what was I thinking about?
Dollar Mug Night adds up.
Oh.
It does, my friend.
And the wharf is the place. I've told the story before. I'll tell it again because I just have a couple minutes left. But the wharf was the place in Alexandria, and it's on Lake Lahamadou, north of town. It's now a Zorba's because there was a little fire. When the wharf wasn't doing so well in its later days, there was a fire.
No.
Yes.
Just popped up.
In the kitchen, the little tiny kitchen they had.
I feel shocked.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think it might have even started in a waste paper basket. And I'm not joking. I think it seriously did.
Just throwing a butt or something out in there?
I'm just saying that maybe there were some questions. Maybe there were some questions. It turned out that the fire marshal said, no, it was a fire, but nothing.
Intentional.
Nope. They had to rule it an accidental fire. But anyway, the wharf was the place where the guy who owned it back in its heyday used to charge for popcorn.
What?
Yes.
Did he at least put Tabasco in the popcorn?
No. He had one of those popcorn, machines that you have in a bar.
Yeah.
That every bar has, if you're smart.
And everybody digs into.
Yep. And he would charge, like 50 cents or a buck for popcorn.
Ridiculous.
And I'm going, buddy, are you kidding me here? I mean, you can't be that hard up. Well, maybe he was. But you can't be that hard up for 50 cents for popcorn because don't you make it up? I would give away every salty product. I'd be giving out pretzels and popcorn. I'd be giving out shakers of salt for free because what happens when you eat popcorn?
I get thirsty.
There you go. You get thirsty when you eat free popcorn. So if you're thirsty in a bar, then what would you do then, Dave, if you're thirsty in a bar?
These pretzels are making me thirsty. I'll have a Miller Lite.
There you go. And so you're going to have more beer, which I assume I don't own a bar, never been a businessman. I assume you're going to make more money off selling beer than you are off selling popcorn for 50 cents at the wharf. Would that not be a logical conclusion to reach?
In theory.
Unbelievable. He sold it and then ended up burning down. And a piece of my childhood my young adult days died that day when the wharf burned down. I'm out of here. Midday Live up next on 970, 93.1. See you tomorrow.